Accession number 20885, Reel 1.
Tom Cook, Reel 1, where were you born, please?
In Hull.
Which year was this?
In 1920.
Your parents come from Hull?
Yes, they were Hull people. Father had been on the fishing industry as an engineer on the trawlers. His father came from West Yorkshire.
From whereabouts?
Near Batley.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in Hull?
Yes, I started school at the Craven Street Primary School in 1925, and then moved on to the Hull Grammar School in 1931.
Can you tell me about getting into Hull Grammar School, what it was like in those days?
Well, there was a scholarship examination, usually at the age of about 10 or 11, and I was fortunate in that I was born in August, and therefore I was at the beginning of the school year. So, of course, I could. I was a few months ahead of anybody else. But they had this scholarship, and it just so happened that in 1930, I had been to Iceland with my uncle as a trawler skipper, as a decky learner, in fact, but just as a really for a trip. And one of the questions in the examination was a holiday, so I described the trawling industry, and that was quite successful.
You were telling me that in those days there were scholarship boys and paying boys.
Yes, well, the grammar school had, the system was, because it was partly financed by the Hull Corporation, they had the right to nominate people for scholarships. And the basis was the scholarship examination or the school entrance examination. And if the parents' income, I think, was over £5 a week, then they had to pay the fees. And the ratio in my class was probably about 5 to 1, the ratio of paying pupils to not to scholarship boys.
Were you discriminated against in any way?
I don't think so. The difficulty was, of course, money. I mean, the other boys had pocket money. They had homes in the more salubrious areas, generally. So that was a bit of a problem. But the boys, of course, the grammar school had pupils from all over the town. So there was no problem about it. They had to go to work on a school on bicycles. Now everybody went on a bike.
And this was at Leicester Street?
Leicester Street School, yes, the old grammar school buildings.
What was it like being in those buildings in those days?
Well, I suppose you just used Craven Street itself was built about the turn of the century, so it wasn't a modern building, and therefore the grammar school was nothing different, really. The classes were about, I think there were 31 to a class, that was the standard. I'm not quite sure why 31 worked out on the desk area, but it was 31 to the class. And we had a form master, and then individual masters for different subjects.
What was the standard of education like in those days?
Well, I think it was very high. I think the demands of the class, of the schooling, were quite high. So much so that I was a bit lost the first year, and I was dropped down into the D stream for the second year. And then gradually moved up and managed to pull myself together and climb up the ladder.
What was the standard of teaching like?
Well, I think it was good, because every teacher, of course, had a degree. It wasn't just teacher training college teachers, and I'm not decrying that, but all the masters had university degrees.
How old were you when you finished at grammar school?
Well, I actually, rather interesting problem. Before they had a matriculation examination, and before the matriculation, the school had a trial, and they would take the first 100 of the pupils, and they would pay the fee for those pupils. And when the results came out in 1935, I came joint 100th with a laddie called Jimmy Wood. And and the teacher said, the headmaster said, well, since you're a year younger than him, you must know the chance next year, so we're putting him forward. And 2 weeks before the exam, they suddenly announced that Jimmy was ill and couldn't take the exam, and I'd be taking it. And I was a bit upset, because the teachers hadn't bothered with me, simply. Anyhow, I did manage to get what they call a school certificate then. So I decided to go back. I decided to go back to the grammar school. But before that, I'd gone to the College of Arts and Crafts to see the principal there. It was Alan. I think it was Alan George. Alan George. Anyhow, the principal said to me, "Oh, you're far too young to come." But when the results came out, of course, I got a letter from him straight away offering me a place in the College of Commerce. Not the College of Arts, the College of Commerce, I should say. And but I decided to go back to the grammar school. And then when I finished my scholarship period at the age of 16, then my father put me into Hodgson Harrison Co., the accountants.
What was life like in Hull in the 30s, pre-war?
Well, very depressing. I mean, there was no money. As far as I'm concerned, my father was unemployed. One brother and two sisters, then another brother came along. So money was extremely tight. I had a deal with my mother that she got my wages, which were, I think, 7 and 6 pence or 10 shillings a week. And I received 2 shillings pocket money. So I didn't drink very much. I didn't drink at all, actually.
Were you in accountancy when war broke out?
Yes, well, I was just an apprentice. We weren't articled as such. We were what they call apprenticed for 5 years. It's rather interesting that my apprenticeship would expire on my 21st birthday. Would have done. But then in 1939, the government brought out the National Service Act, and we were told that if we volunteered for the Territorial Army, that would mean we wouldn't have to serve afterwards. The basis of the National Service Act was you did 6 months in the forces, in the regular service, and 3.5 years with the territorial. But if you did service before that, then you finished your territorial service much sooner. But it was a big con, really, a confidence trick, because if a war came along, everybody was going to be whipped in. So that was it. So I joined the East Yorks in July 1939, and then I remember I was sworn in at East Hill Barracks by Lieutenant Scott, who was the quartermaster, an ex-regimental sergeant major of the East Yorks, marvellous chap. And then the agreement was that I wouldn't have to go to camp. They didn't want me to go to camp particularly, because a lot of people joined the territorials to get that 2 weeks holiday, apart from the bounty. But I didn't go. Well, of course, they had the... I joined the Church Lads Brigade also at St. Columba's Church and went off to a course down in Harrow and London in the middle of August. And of course the war then loomed up, so the course was dispersed. I returned to Hull and on the 1st of September. My father said there'd been a couple of gentlemen round with white armbands on to see why I wasn't in the army. And I reported the next morning to the barracks. Well, it was not a barracks, it was a billiard saloon at the back of the Strand Cinema. That was the battalion headquarters.
Where's the Strand Cinema?
It was near Stepney Crossing, Beverly Road, Stepney Crossing. And the cinema was alongside, and then behind the cinema was this billiard saloon, which we took over as a drill hall, which the army had taken over. And it was the battalion headquarters of the 5th East Yorks, which had about that time about 200 men in total. But there were some men in Lonsborough Barracks as well, in the other barracks. There also was, of course, the 4th Battalion, which was the 1st Territorial Battalion, and then the 5th was a duplicate unit. Then when when I reported, I was kept at headquarters. I'm not quite sure why I wasn't sent to one of the companies, but... as I did parades that were taught to drill and move. Having been in the Church Lads Brigade, of course, I knew a bit about the drill anyhow, which we'd been instructed by a Sergeant Major of the Grenadiers. So we were aware of what to do. And then, after about 2 or 3 weeks, we did weapon training and, well, what weapons they were. It was very, very, very unregimental, I say. We were treated more or less as civilians. There was no harsh words and rude words. It was remarkable. These were our NCOs, some of them were ex-regulars who'd left and then, after serving a few years in these jobs and then come back in for service, been recalled as reservists, you see. And actually, overall, it wasn't too unhappy a time. First of all, I had pocket money I'd never dreamt of. I was getting 2 shillings a week. get it right, 2 shillings a day, plus 1 threepence for not having an overcoat, plus threepence for not having my hair cut properly, and little bits and pieces. And I was suddenly very rich. Very rich. Suddenly I'd, 21, 22 shillings a week from 2 and 6 pence. So I allocated 7 shillings to my mother, and that just carried on whilst I was in the before I was commissioned.
So that was the Saturday you reported for duty?
Yes, yes, that Saturday it was. And then that was then that night we slept on a concrete floor, no blanket, well, 1 blanket each on this concrete floor. There must have been about 50 of us laid out. Two of us, Norman, a young fellow called Norman and I shared our blankets, one underneath and one on top. And we're given a battle dress. I believe I was the first person to be issued with a battle dress, because the rest of the chaps had a service dress before then with buttons. And then trying to sort out the equipment, and the boots were heavy. They had big studs on the bottom. We were given a rifle, a bayonet, a water bottle, gas mask, backpack equipment, all the equipment. And we really didn't know what to do with this, and we were taught how to fold it and how to set it out. And then we... So I slept really the next day, that was on the Saturday. On the Sunday morning, I was working with a chap called Dickie Lee, I'd known before the war, and Lord Middleton, who was the colonel of the battalion. The three of us, along with others, were filling sandbags. It just happened that Lord Middleton was without, we too. And at about 5 to 11, he said, "Oh, come and let's listen to what the Prime Minister's got to say." So we trotted it back into the billiard saloon or the drill hall or whatever, and heard the announcement. He said, "Oh, well, that's it, let's go back to work." So I went back and filled sandbags and made a sentry box or something outside the door.
How did you feel about the news?
I don't think we... Well, I presume the whole change had been so dramatic. I'd gone on this holiday to this trip to this Church Lads Brigade course, and suddenly, then I was in the army, suddenly it just changed it. I suppose you're young, you just accept these things. I was just 19, of course, at this stage. So he just accepted it. That day we're just doing odd things. We were all working, of course. There was no question of getting time off on the Sunday or anything like that. So we getting this going. And then that night we were disturbed about, there was an air raid alarm in the middle of the night, and we're all taken out and piled into a place just outside, which I think it was sort of sandbagged areas, a sort of air raid shelter. And then somebody suddenly shouted gas, and everybody panicked because we didn't know how to put the gas mask on. And nobody knows who shouted gas. I've no idea whether it was a test. Somebody alleged it was a young fellow called, the officer called MacDonald of the Isles, Alistair MacDonald of the Isles. But whether that's true or not, I don't know. But... And then after that, it was parades and drilling and that sort of thing for about 3 weeks. Well, of course, the only interesting thing that happened was that after about 4 days, they suddenly said they wanted somebody who would ride a motorcycle. Well, I'd never been on a motorcycle in my life, so I volunteered anything for a break. So I went outside, and there was this old velocette outside, and the regiment of Sergeant Major was a small chap, but real, really tough fella. And I started to kickstart this, and eventually got it going. Put my crash hands on and the gun and the gloves and set off. I had to take a message to the brigade headquarters in Beverley, just outside the North Bar. And I set off wobbling along as I left. I know the regimental sergeant said, "That little bugger's never been on a bike in his life before." So I went sailing down Beverley Road, chugging away, down through Beverley and to the brigade headquarters. My fear was, when I stopped the engine, whether it would stop. Fortunately, it did. So I set off back. And just for the experience, as I came down Beverley Road, I turned off down, I think it's Cave Street, and went round the back streets, just for a little bit of extra riding. But that was my last sojourn on the motorcycle with East Yorks. First and last.
And then?
Then, we were given a Bren gun. There was a Bren gun we were given, which we used wooden bullets. And fired at the target about 20 yards away. The wooden bullets disintegrated as they hit the target. But of course, we're very short of ammunition, so it was only a question of firing one or two shots each, and then cleaning the damn thing, of course. So then, of course, we're taught how to clean the gun, how to fire, how to line the foresight up with the back sight and all the rigmarole. And then there was the pay parade. And, of course, they used to, the officer, the sergeant major would call out the name, and he'd say, he called out, Cook 798, you'd come to attention, march forward and salute. Well, I went up to the officer and saluted. My hand went up and didn't stop and came straight down. Just like a flash. And the RSM said, hang on. Took me away and he made me practice saluting for an hour before I could get my first pay in the army. But there were people there who couldn't write. The officer had to put his mark, sign his mark. It's unbelievable. Then after about 3 weeks, they suddenly realised that they had a genius in the ranks, so they hoiked me out and made me clerk to the quartermaster, the same officer who'd sworn me in, Lieutenant Scott. And so I was sorting out these forms. Now, I don't know whether I should tell you this, because, well, I suppose it's so long ago. One of the problems was there was a shortage of petrol store, in this petrol store. Now, who'd been using the petrol? Nobody knew. But the fact was, there was a dramatic shortage of petrol in the store with it. So I was given the job of trying to sort it out. And I was given carte blanche to ask any officer or NCO to sign a worksheet and a transport sheet. So I went to all the outstations, measured the distances, checked the proper consumption of vehicles, and concocted journeys out to Catfoss. We had a detachment at Catfoss, I remember, and any other way, and journeys round. And I had all these worksheets signed, and I presented a perfect set, balanced accounts for presentation to the Accountant General of the Army, or the Northern Command, that is. Now, why they didn't suspect anything so perfect, I don't imagine. Can't imagine. But it was a glorious fiddle, it really was. And I really went back. Awful. I mean, later on I became an investigator with the Inland Revenue and and in East Africa, when I went out to East Africa, and I was at the fraud squad. So it came very useful knowing how to find them out. Then that was about that. Then I was on stores, indenting, accounting for stores. And then there was one amusing incident when our regimental quartermaster sergeant, who sort of worked immediately under the lieutenant quartermaster, was a man called Lingwood, DCMM from First World War. His son, Harry, was also in the battalion, by the way. And the RQMS, they constructed a big store at the at the back of the drill hall, the back of the billiards room, or the barracks, whatever. It was called Snapper Barracks, by the way, because Snapper is the East Yorkshire Regiment nickname. And in this store were all the blankets and things, because there was quite a few light-fingered gentlemen about in the army, and so they had to be guarded. And one night, and the regiment sergeant used to sleep on a pile of about 200 blankets. Beautiful bed. Well, they used to get in the sergeant's mess and have a few drinks and then, you know, a few beers and trot off and go off to bed. Well, one night I was guard commander and suddenly I could smell smoke. And I thought, what the hell is that? I'm hunting around. I could smell smoke. And I said, it was in the building. It came from the store. And I went in and the regiment quartermaster sergeant Lingwood had fallen asleep with a cigarette in his mouth. He set fire to the blankets. Well, I looked around and I couldn't find a fire bucket. I couldn't find anything. So I picked up a latrine bucket and it was, had something in it. For the fire. Oh, that's terrible. Right, well, I had to do something. It's called initiative or stupidity, I don't know. So that was the, came very useful. Anyhow, they did get some fire buckets in, but they just never thought of a fire to that sort of thing, presumably. So then, of course, we had the odd do in the evening, you know, the sergeants. Well, somebody would organise a dance or a party and get some civilians in. And we had a bar. And, of course, the corporals in below were only allowed to drink beer. As I didn't drink any beer at all, it didn't really matter to me. And, of course, I remember we had a Sergeant Major Foley, a company sergeant major, who was brilliant at darts. He could put three darts into treble top and double top. The whole board didn't have a treble. it just had a double. The whole dartboard, I don't know why, it was, the dartboard didn't have a treble. So it, but it could put darts into double top, three in a, at any time. Brilliant. Anyhow, then came, well, the family, and my family had been evacuated down into Lincolnshire. So I did a couple of trips down to see them in near Boston. Then in the winter, Christmas, my mother had come home by Christmas, and we were allowed to go home, but I had to report for work each day, Christmas Day, Boxing Day. And because it froze, it was a very bad winter, very severe, and it was so hard, it just had to walk. So I walked from the Blenheim Avenue on Holders Road down to the barracks on Beverly Road, and because the transport just wasn't operating, Christmas Day. Then in the January, the battalion was moved to Bridlington, and the... Oh, before that, I must mention a church parade. The only church parade I went on were the East Yorks. The 4th Battalion were in Hull at the time. And we approached the church in Margaret Street from opposite directions with two bands going, which was very, very confusing. it was chaotic, actually. So we trotted into the church. We all clumped into the church and reading the lessons. And then, of course, to everybody's horror, collection plate coming round and everybody was digging, everybody, lend us a halfpenny, lend us a halfpenny, lend us a halfpenny. This went on, and then I saw something I couldn't believe. One chap dropped a halfpenny into the collection plate, and he had a piece of chewing gum attached to his finger, and whipped a threatening bit out. It was all my first introduction to crime. Well, almost. It was quite terrible. Anyhow, thereafter, we moved to Bridlington, and it was very pleasant there. I mean, my sister lived at Bridlington. We could get home for, if you'd get a pass, you could get home for the weekend, back to home for the weekend. But of course, we did tend to lose contact with our girlfriends and things being away. And then we ate at the dining room, was the cinema. Is it the lounge cinema at Bridlington? The big cinema, very close to the seafront, and that was the dining room. And one day we were sitting down to eat, and there were hundreds of us, and the orderly officer came round, and either I or the chap next to me found a fingernail in the soup or the meat. So the orderly officer ordered the food to be destroyed and redone, and there was a fearful ignored it. I thought it was cooked. Oh dear, it was quite funny. Some of the officers took their duties very seriously. We had two officer cadets with us. In fact, I think in the battalion, in the headquarters, we only had about seven of us with a high school degree, secondary school education. And there was a man called Hollis, I think his father was a vicar, and he was a very nice fellow, very devout chap, very devout. And lots of the chaps have sneered, you know, when he sort of used to say his prayers, but in fact he turned out to be, he was a remarkable, remarkably good man. Lord Middleton, of course, was for World War, was a bit old for active service, and he was relieved by a chap called Given, G-I-V-E-N, I think, Given, and he, a regular colonel, and the second in command was Major Rice, and of course he gradually was trying to pull the battalion together. One of the things I had to do before we moved to Bridlington was to go with the quartermaster and two or three sergeants to Darlington to collect recruits and collect militiamen. Well, they called them militiamen, they were conscripts. And our job was to collect them. We're based in St Cuthbert's Hall, Darlington, all the clerks were. And we spent the whole night just telling jokes and drinking, that sort of thing. And then we had to process them in the next day. They came in, because by the time we got them back to Hull, the battalion consisted of 200 in Hull men and 200 from the rest of the country. And they came from all over. London, Lancashire, Midlands. I think the idea was that they didn't want a repetition of World War I, when after a battle, I mean the newspaper were full of casualties, and I think that was the basis. But the 4th East Yorks, our leading battalion, I had, in fact, all Hull men, local men. And, of course, you know, the 4th Battalion went into the bag, was taken prisoner in the desert. The whole battalion went in and so that the fifth more or less took its place. Anyhow, that was later on. So we were in Bridlington. The scientists were start processing for going, warned for overseas, or France. And my job was to sort of indent for every bit of equipment that was going, what they call the G1098 stores. This is an enormous job. There's a huge manual. You had to write everything, had to be written out by hand with six copies of indenting for this material. Anyhow, we got on with that job and building it up, and they decided that we had to have inoculations. So we all lined up, we all went down to the lounge cinema, and our doctor was Dr. Deacon, a GP from Hull. And as I was lined up and we rolled our sleeves back and were jabbed, we had TB, TT, smallpox, TB, tetanus. There were three or four jabs, I know. And one of them were excused duty for 48 hours afterwards because it really gave you a temporary sort of fever. And as we were lining up, there were these, some of these big, tough, you remember how the whole battalion was big, tough blokes that could chuck weights around, they were tough as nails. And they were fainting as they saw the doctor put the needle into somebody's arm. They fainted. It was mind-boggling, actually. So that was that, and we went off to, and then we assembled for the thing. Now, back to the stores business, it's funny. We'd been allocated a Bren carrier. This was a tracked vehicle that carried a little Bren gun, a Bren carrier, and for training and practice. I managed to drive it once or twice. Well, not very well, but I managed to get into it. Anyhow, along we're ordered to transfer it to an ordnance depot somewhere. So I said, right, so we already got it processed, and off it went. And that was that. However, when we came back from France, we kept getting requests for this Bren carrier. Where was it? We kept writing and telling what had happened. And in the end, the quartermaster said, right, exit into the service. And that was it. So somebody finished up with a Bren carrier. So then we were on for France, and this advance party went off in April, I think. We were then told to assemble, and of course, although I was with the stores, I was part of the normal battalion for duty purposes. So we all assembled, I think it's somewhere in the lounge cinema, with our big backpack on, rifle, bayonet, gas mask on, small pack, water bottle. And when we marched down to the station, it was just like going off to war in the South African War. You know, soldiers of the Queen, that sort of thing. It was weird. We actually marched down and people cheering as we got on the train and then went down to Southampton. We arrived in Southampton and overnight, of course, and then we're put onto a boat. I think it was one of the Isle of Man steamers. Probably got it recorded somewhere. And we finished up in Le Havre. So we spent the whole of that day in a shed in Le Havre. We managed to get some food. We managed to get us some food, but we had haversack rations for the, you know, 24 hours rations of sandwiches and things. And I remember thinking, well, this is an odd thing. If there's a bomb dropped here, the whole battalion would go out. But there we are. This happened. So we then got onto a train, which was a French third-class train with wooden seats. Little did I know that it would have been the most comfortable train journey I'd ever have, because we were taken to a little place called Yvetot, inland from Le Havre, and then to march to a small village called Touffreville, where the battalion was based temporarily. The thing I remember that is, we're in the stores, I think cigarettes were fourpence for 20, because they were duty free. Tobacco was about sixpence a tin. It was all duty free stores, of course, so the army since we were abroad. And the other thing I remember is that the toilet, our toilet, was a pole across a ditch, and we just went in the open. And we were open to the road, and we could see the French girls trotting back watching us. It was awful. Anyhow, so I went off to, remember, a couple of hours, my Howard Turner, the armourer, he was an ordnance corps man, and I went off for a decent bath to Yvetot, to the town itself. And then a couple of days later, we were told to pack up, and we moved. We marched in the pouring rain bucketing down to a place called Le Fouché, where we got onto cattle trucks, you know, 8 horses, 40 men, sort of thing, and we travelled overnight, soaked to the skin, you know, absolutely wet, overnight to a little village. What was the little village called? Not Grévilliers. Anyhow, to a small halt, we disembarked there and marched to our station.